Why are they still fighting over Columbus statues in 2025? You know, like hundreds of years go by, decades. Every October, there was a Columbus painting in Madrid was just splattered with red paint. There was a statue somewhere in the Midwest was just torn down. I mean, this is going on all the time, right? Why?
That's Matthew Restall, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. Matthew Restall is a professor of history and anthropology and director of Latin American studies at Penn State University. His previous books include Seven Myths of the Spanish Conquest and When Montezuma Met Cortez, The True Story of the Meeting That Changed History, among other books. He joins us to discuss The Nine Lives of Christopher Columbus. Matthew, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you for having me on the program. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you've written numerous books about history. Why did you want to write about Christopher Columbus?
Well, that's an obvious question to ask anybody about any book, I suppose, but I think it's particularly obvious with Christopher Columbus, because as I discovered in the course of researching the book, there are thousands of books written about Columbus. I think possibly as many as 2,000 in the last 200 years. He's one of the most written about historical figures in American history. And yes, he's part of American history, right? So why on earth would I want to do that? And in fact, if you had asked me over most of the 30 years or so that I've been working as a professional historian, I would have said, the world does not need another book on Christopher Columbus. And I'm certainly not going to spend my time writing one. There's many other topics to write on. So your question is, it kind of resonates with me perhaps more even than you realize. And what changed my mind was a kind of a eureka moment that I do describe at the beginning of the book, which is I was in the Spanish province of Galicia, visiting friends, taking little time off from doing research in Spain. So this visit was not a research visit. And I'm talking to my friends and they introduce me to their neighbors and we get discussing what I do for a living and the kinds of things I've written about. You know, as you mentioned, I've written books about various aspects of Spanish empire history, Mayas, Aztecs, and so on. So they go, oh, well, that you'd be very interested being here then. I mean, that, maybe that's why you're here, in fact, because, you know, as you may know, Columbus, who discovered America, was from here. And I thought they were teasing me, right? I thought they must be kidding. No, they're very serious. No, he's from here. They even had details. They even had his original name, his Gallego name. And they said the castle where he lived is not far from here. So, you know, the next day off I went. They took me to the castle, medieval castle, beautifully restored, with historical displays inside the rooms, including one explaining that the local Gallego nobleman who lived in this castle in 1492 changed his name to Christopher Columbus, to Cristobal Colón, and sailed the Atlantic Ocean and discovered America. So, I mean, I don't know about you. I don't know about people listening to this, but that was a little kind of mind-blowing for me, particularly as someone who had spent decades talking about Columbus in the classroom, writing a little bit about him there, here and there, kind of fancied myself, I don't know, kind of a minor authority perhaps on Columbus, certainly on his kind of worlds. I thought this is something that needs to be explained. And I don't mean I thought, oh, I have to write a book just about the Gallego Columbus, although that had occurred to me. But I thought, no, this needs to be presented to all of the people that I have talked to Columbus about over the years, to this kind of larger audience. It needs to be connected to all these other Columbus conundra, like, for example, why are people fighting over Columbus statues? Why are they still fighting over Columbus statues in 2025? You know, like hundreds of years go by, decades, every October, there was a Columbus painting in Madrid was just splattered with red paint. There was a statue somewhere in the Midwest was just torn down. I mean, this is going on all the time, right? Why? So I thought there has to be a way to connect all of this stuff. Maybe it's already been done before. And then the title of the book just came right into my head, right? Standing outside that castle. The Nine Lives of Christopher Columbus. And I thought the title was so good, The Nine Lives, if you'll, it sounds terrible as an author boasting about how good the title of his book is, but I was so taken with this title, I thought there's no way that just popped into my head. It must be a poem or a song, or someone must have come up with that title before, right? And I did spend some months kind of trying to track down the title. And when I couldn't, I decided, oh, I guess that's my book. I have to write it. And The Nine Lives will provide me with a framework in which I can try to answer all of these different Columbus questions, all within sort of, you know, between two covers. So it's an answer to all the questions you have about Columbus, I hope, and much more interesting, an answer to all the questions you never knew you had about Columbus.
Well, I want to come back to the question about his birth, because that's not the only place that claims that Columbus was born there. So, and that gets to a lot of what you talk about in the book. There's the mythology, and then there's what we think we know as fact about Christopher Columbus. So you piqued my curiosity, and maybe it's a spoiler, but where was he born?
Right. Well, so I thought, well, I'm going to, one of these lives will be the Colon Gallego, right? He'll be this Galician nobleman. That'll be one of the lives. That'll be a whole chapter. But when I started to do the research, I discovered something I kind of was vaguely aware of, but I didn't realize how widespread this phenomenon was, that there were dozens of places claiming him. I mean, I think I'm up to something like it's in the book, but then I keep finding more. So I think even though the book just came out last week, I guess might already be out of date by one or two of these places. I think 11 cities in Italy and 17 different countries around Europe claiming Columbus. So in fact, two of the nine lives go down those rabbit holes trying to explain that. And I grouped all the Iberian ones together and all the non-Iberian ones together, all the while trying to keep an open mind. As you said, Dan, where was he really from? I'm like, that was the mindset I tried to approach this all with. Like maybe so many people are claiming him because this really is a mystery, that we really don't know where he was from. And this, I hate to, as you said, to give a spoiler, but a kind of a disappointing spoiler as well. He was from Genoa. I mean, I hate to call it a theory because it wasn't a theory, but the original idea was right all along. And in fact, he was always from Genoa. And no one questioned that in the beginning because it was so blatantly obvious and the evidence is absolutely overwhelming. But of course, as soon as you simply establish the premise, you just say, well, it's not clear, it's a mystery. Just take my word for it. It's a mystery. And we just throw out a few factoids, like, for example, well, you know, there's no birth certificate was ever found. Well, you know, his professional historians of the early modern period, I realize this in no way encompasses like everybody who reads books, right? But those folks know that the birth certificates that we take for granted weren't invented, if you like. They weren't required by the church until more than 100 years after Columbus was born. So nobody had birth certificates in Genoa in the 1450s when he was born. So, you know, there's little facts that get thrown out there that can easily be kind of punctured in order to take you back to that, the simple fact that he was from Genoa. But I would say, okay, that might seem like a little disappointing. Oh, you're not going to tease our minds, blow our minds with some whole theory about he really was a Greek pirate. That's one theory. He really was from Switzerland. He was from, pick your Mediterranean island, right? Mallorca, Corsica. There are claims for all of these places. But I think actually, it's in a way more interesting to realize how many claims there are and then to begin to explain them, right? And so that takes us away from Columbus into European history. You know, I discovered when I was investigating the Galicia claim that around the same time, their claims began to surface in Portugal. And in fact, not coincidentally, somebody gave a lecture in Lisbon from Galicia saying, I've got this idea and here's my evidence. And a lot of the evidence was, for example, to do with place names. saying, look how all the places in the Caribbean that Columbus gave names to are also place names in Galicia. And somebody in the Portuguese audience in Lisbon thought, huh, well, those place names are in southern Portugal as well. Of course, you know, anybody listening to this will go, well, sounds to me like these might be kind of common place names, you know, and they are common place names all over anywhere where there's people naming things in Spanish, coastlines, rivers, you know, capes, a lot of places named after saints and so on. So it's not really evidence, but the Portuguese took that same sort of set of evidence and then applied it to Portugal. And this was, now we're talking about back in the 1890s. So now there's a rivalry that forms in the 1890s between these two places, which have a long, complicated history of being very entwined and rival, and also being rivals, Portugal and Galicia, sort of historically like siblings, right? Like siblings that get on really well and share the same DNA, but also sort of, you know, fight and jostle and argue about things. So there's a lot of rivalry there, and that has gone on for the last 130 years. It's still going. So what I love about the Columbus story, particularly about the way I've approached it here, is it's about so many things. There's so much in here. You know, for a book that's not that long, there's a lot of stuff, and I can see future scholars kind of going through and saying, okay, this paragraph is interesting. I'm going to explode this and take this in a whole other direction and research this.
One of the things I find fascinating about this whole Columbus story and all these myths that have grown up around him is that there are gaps in his story, and people have just filled it in. They've made things up. And if you repeat it often enough, someone thinks it's fact. And, you know, there we go, all these Columbus stories.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm sure that's something you come across over and over, right? If you repeat something enough times. I can't remember who was it who said it, but these are the kinds of things that get attributed to everybody from sort of Oscar Wilde to Churchill to Plato. You know, if you repeat something enough times loud enough, people begin to accept it as fact. Well, you know, Columbus, because of his role as the first European that crosses that ocean, when he does, right? I realize there were Vikings that crossed it before and probably others, but the fact that he was part of the process involving many thousands of Europeans that led to colonization and so on means that anything relating to him has garnered attention over the centuries. And therefore, when you've got your attention focused on someone a lot, people want the full story. And they want certain elements in that story. They want sort of heroes and anti-heroes. The heroes can be flawed, but there needs to be a hero. They need to be able to kind of relate to a core character. So Columbus has sort of been invented and reinvented over and over to kind of match the mood, the culture of a particular moment. Like, what do we need from our heroes? Right now, there's a lot of sort of people contorting themselves. You could, maybe somebody could be critical of my book and say I'm doing the same thing, but contorting themselves to try to present Columbus as not a hero or a villain, but somebody who is actually very kind of human. And I would argue, by sort of making him neither saint nor great sinner, you know, neither hero nor villain, but somebody very much kind of in the middle, he is someone who's a little bit more kind of relatable to. But I have a feeling, Dan, you're referring to something that I haven't mentioned. A good story needs some kind of a romance, right? There's got to be, I mean, that's what we expect. And that's been in our culture for thousands of years. Some experts on world literature would say, oh no, that's in all cultures. People want a really good story that has to be some kind of a romance in there. And the problem with Columbus's story is that there isn't really a romance there. And that was something I investigated pretty hard. I mean, it you know, there wasn't anything there. And I thought, maybe this is kind of a non-starter. Maybe there isn't a whole life here of my nine lives. But I kept coming across people just really wanting there to be a romance. And, you know, there's an entire book about his romance with Queen Isabel, based on one phrase that he may have written in one letter that has sort of picked out and turned into kind of a metaphor for sex, and then sort of expanded out to make this kind of entire vision of Columbus in love with the queen and the queen in love with him, and that's why she supports his voyages and so on. I get it. It's a nice twist. It's a really nice element in the story. There's no evidence for it whatsoever, and there isn't evidence for any other romances involving Columbus, but that's fine. Put them in. As long as you make it clear that you're writing a historical novel, I'm very happy for people to write historical novels in which Columbus is having all kinds of love affairs, or conversely, that Columbus is committing crimes of bestiality in the Caribbean, because that's one of the other little bits of Colombiana myths that I went at and tried to explain in the book. There's a little teaser for someone to be, what? Yes, manatees. It involves manatees. Maybe we'll say no more, Dan, and that'll be enough to get somebody to buy the book.
Given what you know about Columbus, because he remains such a controversial figure, and as you pointed out, statues have been taken down. People don't want to celebrate Columbus Day, for example. At least some people don't. But given what you know about him, flaws and all, how do you think we should look at him today?
Yeah, that's sort of the, as they used to say, the $65,000, it was $64,000 question. How should we look at him today? I think an important part of my book is at the end, when I identify two of his lives, lives 8 and 9, as being what I call the American Columbus and the Italian American Columbus. And the reason I emphasize the difference between those two Columbuses, even though in many cases they overlap, it's very easy to confuse them. I think a lot of comments that are made about Columbus today, political comments, even comments coming out of the White House, reactions to that, all of this stuff, a lot of the time is confusing those two Columbuses. And I think as long as they're confused, that continues to kind of to stimulate not just controversy or controversy, but also conflict over Columbus. He becomes a battleground. And then all you can do with the statues is, attack them, tear them down, or defend them, move them to save them. There's no real conversation going on there. And I think once you see that they're two separate Columbuses, that allows for more of a conversation. Because I think that then those who are defending Columbus as a sort of patriotic icon of a certain kind of America, a certain kind of vision of America, are able to see why they have some things in common, but also some things not in common with people who are defending a kind of an Italian-American Columbus, and also can understand why others would be so upset and would see Columbus as a symbol of slavery, of the transatlantic slave trade, of that history, of indigenous American history, and the catastrophe that is visited upon indigenous peoples once Europeans arrive, right? The massive population loss and changes to their culture and so on, let alone also another history of enslavement as well. So I think the first step is to sort of see how what these different positions are and why people think that about Columbus. Like, what are the origins and explanations for their positions? That's, I think, how we should see Columbus, as somebody not simply to be kind of worshipped or attacked, but as someone who allows us to have really good conversations about the roots of our nation and the history of the last 500 years. I mean, he's sort of like a door, a window that opens up that history.
Well, there's much more in this book that we didn't have time to talk about. So to learn more, the book is The 9 Lives of Christopher Columbus by Matthew Restall. Matthew, thank you for talking with me today.
Oh, thank you for having me on the show. Much appreciated.
You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. You can use the KPR app to listen to the latest episodes on your phone or tablet, and you'll also find us on Facebook. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.